This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Welcome to Season 4, Episode 20, Resolvers. I'm Eliza.
I'm Allison.
I'm Carlin.
And this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. We're getting deep into Season 4, y'all.
Yeah, we are.
Deep in there. We've got some business to take care of before we get started. First, as many of you know, for every review that we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization. And as we mentioned last episode, this month's is St. Jude's Children's Hospital, suggested by patron Beth H. So thank you, Beth. Of course, you can help us donate to St. Jude's by leaving us a review. We'd love to read your thoughts, especially if it's good.
Yes.
Just don't do it if it's bad. Just don't do it.
Just move on. Find a different podcast.
Allison, do you want to shout out our patrons?
Sure. We'd like to thank Full Metal Jackalope, Jody H., Gidget H., Elizabeth L., Tara M., Karen K., Amanda B., and Justin W. Thank you so much, guys. We appreciate your support.
Thank you. Also, Gidget is the cutest name.
I know. When I saw that, I was like, I love that name. Annette Funicello was Gidget.
Yep. So cute. So if you'd like to be able to suggest a nonprofit or be able to have ad-free episodes or extra content from us surrounding true crime and unsolved mysteries, you can go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast and you'll also get a shout out on the show. Okay, one last bit of business that needs to be attended to. Our Malort is here. We should say this came from Peggy.
Yes, Peggy. We would say thank you, but...
What's this called? What do we call it?
Pick our poison.
Pick our poison.
In this case, Peggy definitely picked our poison, because this smells like poison.
Which you can do at resolvemysteriespodcast.com? Question mark?
Yep.
Okay. And Peggy did that. She kicked in some money for us to purchase this drink, which Allison brought to my home in a Tupperware. It is yellow, so I am holding a pee sample right now. A pee sample of someone who is not drinking enough water.
Yep, that's fully what it looks like. Because I knew you had ordered one bottle, and I was like, how is she going to parse this out to us? Yes, it's in little Tupperwares.
You know this bitch has Tupperware for days.
So much Tupperware.
So we are going to try this. It's apparently a Chicago staple. Everything we've heard about it is horrendous.
So we have gotten multiple messages from folks about Malort, which goes to show we're in for something. And I just wanted to call out a couple really funny ones. Listener Nicole said, Malort tastes like Band-Aid smell.
God.
It's one of the worst things I've ever drank.
Oh. Okay.
And I've accidentally chugged from the cigarette butt cut more than once.
Oh, my God. Ew.
And listener Sarah said, a friend of mine moved from Chicago from our small town, and whenever he comes home, he brings a bottle to do shots with. I would like to add a review of the taste. Tire fire. Imagine a tire fire in your mouth.
Oh my God.
No.
And then another adorable listener had sent us a video of her having a shot of it.
Yeah. So. I had a listener send a video of her brother trying it for the first time too.
Oh my God.
I do want to say too, you know, I'm doing a dry January. So this is the only alcohol that I am going to drink all January, and I am so upset about it.
That is really horrifying.
It's terrible. Oh, no. Subsequently, I now have 4 beverages on my desk right now to chase whatever the hell this is going to taste like.
I'm really scared.
Okay, ready? I'm going
to
pour a shot.
No, I have to pour it into the shot glass
from
the Tupperware.
Me too.
Honey, this is, you gave me a large portion.
I know. Well, I mean, they came.
She's afraid she'll like it so much that she'll have to keep drinking it and break her dry January. So she had to stretch it out.
Oh, my God.
Okay. I'm not going to lie. I'm only pouring a half glass.
Okay. But Carlin, this is a Swedish drink. So you need to get on top of it.
Oh, wait. Let me read you the description on the back of the bottle. Okay. Jepson's Malort has the aroma and full-bodied flavor of, quote, an unusual botanical. Mm-hmm. Its bitter taste is savored by two-fisted drinkers. What does that mean?
Heavy alcoholics.
I also love how they say it's an unusual blend, but they don't give any detail as to what's in that blend.
No, nary a detail.
Tire fire.
My nose is burning off right now.
I don't know, because I like some aquavit, but this is not...
This says, here's an ad from 1953, the world's driest dry liquor.
Ew.
If Jepson were a horse, Jepson Malort, which it ain't, and you are a rider, which possibly you ain't neither, you might then like to switch. You just don't switch from drinking
gin. What the fuck?
I don't know. Cut that. Okay. Here we go. I'm drinking out of my Tupperware.
Oh, no. I'm really, really scared.
Okay, ready?
Come on.
What if I throw up? Okay.
Okay. Ready?
Oh, wow.
One, two, three.
Ah!
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh. Not even that bad at all. What? To me, it tastes like bitters.
It is. It's Swedish bitters.
The aftertaste is like garbage.
Tastes like Band-Aid smell. I'm not getting that.
Oh, my God.
It smells really terrible, but I don't think it tasted as bad as it smells.
I am getting... What am I getting?
What are you getting, Eliza? Please tell us.
I'm getting some herbaceous. I'm pouring a second glass, by the way, as I say this.
Why?
Jesus.
Wow.
I don't know if I'm actually going to
drink it. I will
tell
you this.
I'll run you the bottle.
Does not leave your mouth. Yeah.
It's lingering.
I've drank three different things, and I can still taste it.
It's...
One of the things I drank was bone broth, and I can still taste it.
Oh, wow. It smells so bad.
Yeah.
But it does not taste as bad.
Carlin loves it.
I don't love it, but to me it just tastes a lot like herbs and bitters.
Try it again, Carlin.
Okay. I love you sipping it out of that Tupperware like a cat.
Like a two-fisted cat.
Oh, my God.
The taste doesn't go away. The taste is forever in my mouth.
Carlin loves it. Look at
she
her.
Does.
It's really not that bad.
Oh, I wow. want your husband to try it. I'm curious. Gosh.
Oh, he has. He's like, what did Allison just drop on the porch? And I was like, Malort. And he was like, oh.
It's not as bad as I was expecting, but it is not good.
Yeah.
It is not good.
Yeah.
I don't want it.
I wouldn't choose it.
I wouldn't drink it again.
My whole mouth. Is Malort now.
Yeah, it's gross.
My entire esophagus
I feel
is
like
Malort
it's like
now.
Stuck to the back of my tongue and will be forever.
I don't get it. Why does it linger?
It's still there.
Okay, well, Peggy, I'm glad I had that experience.
Yeah, Peggy, it wasn't that bad, but I don't want to do it again ever.
Which is what we expected. I'm curious to know, do people make cocktails with Malort and is it better? Is it ever used in a drink?
Like with some simple syrup, like maybe like brown sugar simple syrup or something?
Ooh, that sounds kind of nice. I wonder, or an apple. I feel like an apple something would
that
be
makes
good.
Sense. Yeah. Well, we've got a little left. So if you want to come over in February, we can make some mixed Malort drinks.
Yeah, because that's what we need to be doing instead of using your new cocktail recipe book.
My Nomad recipe book. I'm very excited. We're going to have a cocktail party in February.
February 1st,
sure.
Baby.
February 1st.
All right. Let's move on.
Okay. Let's never speak of that again.
Thank you, Peggy.
Thanks, Peggy.
If others want to pick our poison, you may.
Yes. You can go to resolvemysteriespodcast.com and then there is a tab that says advertising and support and you can pick our poison there. Ugh. All right.
It's never going to leave.
No.
It's still here.
It's forever.
All right. Carlin, this is an interesting one. Only two segs to cover, but one of them is the amount of five segs. So,
yep. So we discovered while I was watching it that there was only two segs, and it's because this one was 30 minutes long.
Oof!
No, no, no.
So this is, sorry, I don't have the document up. I'm really distracted by
Richard Mins.
No, I know what it is. Trust me. This is the wanted segment of Richard Mins.
And then the second segment is a Lost Heirs segment, and it's the story of Catherine Bennett.
All right.
Ready?
Let's.
Should we go brush our teeth?
I think we should not, and we should give an update on when the Malort taste finally leaves our mouth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Let's do it.
Here we go. Okay. Okay. All right. I have Malort all over my fingers. It's everywhere.
You got tire fire fingers.
Tire fire fingers. Band-aid smell. Okay.
Okay.
So this is the wanted segment of Richard Mins. And please bear with the length of time we are going to spend on this.
How many pages you got going there?
I believe I have 11.
Whoa.
Oh, baby.
If not more. Okay. So we do have an intro with a quintessential trench coat stack in the fog.
Fog stack.
But we're going to skip the intro because they gave a lot of the story before we actually hear the story.
Cool.
So Richard Min and Barbara Petrowski met in January of 1977 on the ski slopes of Aspen, Colorado. Stack says that Barbara was only 23 and very naive, and Richard was 47 and a sophisticated, smooth-talking comedian who could adjust to any situation. So then we have an interview with Barbara, and she says when Richard first approached her, he was loud, he was dressed in a fluorescent yellow ski suit, and he was bragging about what a great guy he was.
Ew.
Yep. She says, when he saw how it affected me, he quickly changed his persona.
That's scary.
Which is a red flag.
Yeah, that's not a good thing, Barbara. Mm-hmm.
She says, he became quiet, charming, and almost shy. And I also do need to mention the very weird saxophone music that is playing under Barbara's entire interview.
Oh, I don't think I noticed that.
It is a lot, and it is very distracting. Barbara says eventually she fell head over heels in love with Richard. Then Stack says Richard Mins was anything but shy. He was a dedicated, flamboyant bodybuilder. And then they show a swimsuit photo of him while Stack is saying this. Stack tells us he made millions from a chain of upscale health spas based in Texas, which I do need to tell you, in my research, I discover the name of these health spas was President and First Lady Health Spas.
What? Yeah, that's definitely what I think of when I think of a president and a first lady is a gym and a health spa.
Why?
It will become more clear as we move along.
Okay.
Oh.
Stack says he was a man who always got what he wanted, and he wanted Barbara.
Ew.
Barf, 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 barf.
And the amount of images, you mentioned the swimsuit one, but the amount of images that they have to show is so many.
Stack says within 3 months, Barbara had moved from L.A. to Houston to live with Richard. He had hired her to model for his health spas, quote, lavished her with attention and centered his life around her. So this is all over like a very weird reenactment where Richard is presenting Barbara with a birthday cake that has vacation pictures of them airbrushed on it. Mm-hmm. It's very weird. So Stack says that Richard even told Barbara that his contacts could get her a spot in medical school. So she had wanted to become a doctor. Barbara said it was incredibly romantic and it was too good to be true. Things like this don't happen in real life. They happen in a story. They happen in a movie, but they don't happen to you. Barbara says they had a good relationship. Quote, it was magical, so there was no indication whatsoever in the beginning that there was anything that was really amiss. So they do a reenactment, and one night there is a knock at their door, and Barbara goes to answer the door. The woman at the door, who is wearing a fur coat for this whole moment,
sure is,
says, my husband is in your house, and I want to see him right now. So it turns out Richard is fucking married, and this is a woman his own age named Mimi that's at the door. Barbara says Richard explained this all to her by saying that he didn't tell her because he loved her so much and he wanted her to move to Houston with him and he knew that she'd be hesitant if she found out he was still married and he just loved her so much that he'd even compromise his own integrity and lie to her to get her to come live with him because he just loved her so much.
Gross.
Oh my gosh.
So he's like, I'm legally separated. I'm just not divorced yet. They end up breaking up for a little while, but eventually, quote, Barbara accepted Richard's explanation and his peace offering. So the peace offering was that he bought a townhouse for the two of them to live in together, and he put everything in Barbara's name so that it all belonged to her. So he's like showing his devotion and dedication with this.
Gross.
Meanwhile, he is still married. Barbara explains that Richard didn't want her to work for anyone but him. He wanted her to focus on her, on their relationship and her education. He bought her the townhouse and all that to give her security that she didn't need to worry about holding down a job that wouldn't pay her nearly what he could make in a day. Mm. 3 months later, Barbara would learn more truth about Richard. In May of 1978, Richard's wife had filed for divorce when she found out about the townhouse. So Barbara says while he was going through the divorce, he became a completely different person and that it shocked and appalled her. She says he became paranoid and violent. So Richard becomes more and more of a dick, and the actor playing him does a really great job. He is disgusting and aggressive and scary. And he became worse and worse after the divorce settlement was finalized with his wife. She had started the health spa business with him. So I think that's why it was like president and first lady. They just had this really like inflated sense of self, I think.
Jeez.
So after this settlement is finalized, she was awarded $6 million.
Wow.
So he gets real mad. Oof. So then there's a really scary reenactment. He's being super angry and aggressive after reading something in the finance section of the newspaper. And she's trying to calm him down. She's like, oh, it's okay. And like trying to hug him and stuff. And he just starts being a total dick. Stack tells us that Barbara had recently found out she was pregnant. And Richard had suddenly put his plans to marry her on hold.
Lovely.
I read at one point that they did have a wedding ceremony in Mexico. So I'm wondering if it was more of just a ceremony and there was plans to have a legal marriage afterward.
Yeah, I could see that.
Which is where some of the complications later come in.
Okay. Mm.
She's trying to calm him down. He's getting more and more angry. And he, like, grabs her and shakes her. And then she's like, be careful. I told you I'm pregnant. And this just sends him off. So he starts saying to just abort the baby. And she's like, no. And he's like, abort it. I don't want it. I don't want a child. Ugh. And he ultimately says she better abort it or get out of his house. So UM does not mention this, but at one point, apparently, he also fractured her nose during one of their arguments.
Oh, my God.
So there was, like, definitely abuse going on.
Yes.
Before, as they say in UM, she decides it's not safe for her or her child. And she decides to move out of the house and take everything with her. So Barbara says this was a really confusing time for her. She didn't actually want to leave him. She loved him. And she says it felt like tearing away a part of herself, like ripping off her own arm. Which just goes to show you the type of hold these manipulative dick bitches can have on people.
Yeah.
Author Suzanne Finstad is then interviewed, and Stack explains that she spent 3 years researching and writing the book Sleeping with the Devil about Barbara and Richard's story.
And based on her hair, she has only been doing that for 3 years and nothing else, but also in a windstorm.
She's been a little busy.
It was funny when they would interview her and Barbara, the juxtaposition of the two women.
I know.
Go back and forth. Although I liked the author. I liked her vibe. It was chaotic and I appreciated it.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So Suzanne tells us how Barbara had actually moved out several times, and every time the relationship would just stay the same. There was no change. So this time she felt like she needed to do something really dramatic, which is why she decided to take all the furniture with her. So Richard comes home to the townhouse, and there is nothing inside, and he is enraged. He somehow gets his sister to talk to Barbara, and he asks the sister to have Barbara come meet with him. So Barbara says, even though she knew it was a big mistake, she felt like she had to at least see what he had to say. It's like, no, girl.
No. Nope.
You really don't. You really don't.
Because he's a maniac.
So Barbara goes to Richard's hotel room, but he wasn't there, which, like, he fucking asked her to come meet him. He's not there when she gets there. So she waits in the hallway, and she's, like, hoping they can work something out. She waits until after midnight, when Richard comes back with a girl.
Yeah.
He asked her to come. I know. He staged all of this.
Yeah.
Ugh. So this girl and him are flirting and kissing, and she confronts him, and she's like, I thought you loved me. And she starts actually walking away, and he runs after her. And according to Barbara, he forcibly detains her and won't let her leave. And he tells her that he wants her to come in and they can work it out. And he does love her, and she needs to come in and talk to him. Meanwhile, the new girl that he's standing there with is just like standing in the hallway, and he like walks by her and kisses her, and he's like, wait for me.
Yeah.
And then he goes in the hotel room with Barbara. It's like, what are any of these women supposed to think?
Doesn't he say like, I'll be right back or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ew.
Yeah.
Why do any of them think this is a good situation to be in?
I don't know. Maybe because he's rich.
Yeah. So they go back into the hotel room. In the hotel room, Richard is holding Barbara in his arms, and, you know, he's kind of like saying, we're going to work it out and stuff. Then suddenly the door busts open, the police come in, and Richard literally throws Barbara to the police and says, here she is.
Oh, my God.
He says he's got a warrant for her arrest. He says she stole everything from him, his jewelry, his gun, the furniture, everything. So Minns had used his connections to get a warrant for Barbara's arrest, and one of his associates had called the police for him.
Mm.
So they arrest Barbara.
Ridiculous.
She says, what he did to me that night was like taking a knife and just ripping my heart straight open. Mm. But believe it or not, even after what he did that night, I was still in love with him.
Barbara! No, girl.
It is so sad.
Mm-hmm.
So Barbara spends the night in jail. And early in the morning, a detective comes to see her, and he says, if you settle up with Dick Minns, we can forget about this whole thing. So he says he has some documents for her to sign, and he hands her an agreement that is going to make her state that she never knew Richard, she never had a relationship with him, and that she is not carrying his child.
Mm.
And Barbara is, of course, like, no, those are all giant lies. I'm not signing this. So she refuses. Barbara ends up getting charged with felony grand theft and aggravated assault since she had hit Richard with her purse while they were in the hotel.
Oh, my God.
It's just so backwards from what needs to be happening right now. Less than 36 hours later, Barbara had a miscarriage due to the stress of this whole situation.
It's terrible. That's exactly what he wanted.
Yeah, totally. She ends up not telling Richard about the miscarriage, which was smart of her. So this already is like the most terrible story, and this is only the beginning.
Yeah.
Yes.
Barbara's former attorney, Irv Weissman, is interviewed and says that Richard got the warrant and the attention of the authorities because of who he was.
Ugh.
He says he felt that the district attorney's office would never have made charges unless they felt they could make a prima facie case and get a conviction.
Prima facie?
Prima facie.
I don't know what that is.
So that's when it's like, from first glance, it looks like you have obvious reasons for the case, basically.
Cool.
He says when he read over everything, he felt it would be an easy case to defend. When Barbara was released from jail, she went into hiding.
Mm.
So just some stuff that was not mentioned in UM. During this time, Barbara continues her studies at the University of Houston and continues to teach aerobics classes.
Hmm.
At some point, she becomes a registered nurse and starts work as a critical care nurse at Houston Hospital.
Oh, my gosh. While all of this insanity is happening, she's still
like
succeeding.
Never not doing something.
Oh,
ever.
My gosh.
So Richard hires a PI named Dudley Bell, who was, quote, notorious for operating on the edge of the law. So Bell finds Barbara for Richard. And there was another incident during this time that UM did not mention, which I'm shocked by. During this time, while she's in hiding, Barbara starts to feel like she's being watched and followed.
Mm.
So one day in August 1980, her car stalls unexpectedly while she's driving around town. And she is just on high alert, so she calls the police about it.
Yeah. Mm.
They find that installed under the hood, there is a remotely controlled ignition cutoff switch.
Oh, my God.
So someone literally pressed a button and was able to have the car shut off?
Well, there was something wrong with it where it wasn't functioning quite properly. So I don't think that's when it was intended to have happened.
Oh. But it could have happened.
But someone installed it.
Oh.
So, and then we're going to jump back into UM. On April 17th, 1980, two Houston police detectives served Barbara with a search warrant. Stack says Barbara was about to find out that Richard had planned the entire thing. So the detective tells Barbara they're just going to have a look around. Suddenly, as they're in there, Richard appears in the doorway. Like, she hasn't seen him. She's been in hiding. He just appears in her doorway. And other officers come in, and he starts pointing to things, saying, like, that's mine, that's mine, that's mine.
Oh, my God.
So Barbara's like, I don't want him in here. This is my house. These are my things. She's like, he gave me these things. Like, she had these papers saying everything was hers, you know?
Yeah.
So he, oh, and then there are movers outside the door ready to just take everything. And this to me is an obvious sign that the police were working with him.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, this is not normal.
Oh, no.
This is not, this is not okay. This is not how this works.
Well, even the one police officer saying, we'll make this all go away if you just sign these, like, documents that have all these lies. Like, that isn't how the police work. They're not supposed to do things like that.
No.
No.
No, no, no. And then, so, okay, so then the movers come in. Richard takes everything and puts it in storage, which is just fucking petty.
Oh,
he's not so using the furniture.
He's
rich as fuck. He doesn't need the furniture.
No. Mm-hmm.
He just wants her to not have it. He wants to torment her and ruin her life in any way he can.
Yeah, absolutely. She hurt his ego. Full stop.
So Richard continues to try to get Barbara to sign these papers saying that she won't sue him. So the lawyer explains he was trying to make sure she wouldn't pursue litigation with respect to marriage or paternity. So I think that, like, wedding in Mexico did have play in here because they weren't legally married, but she kept saying they were married and that he was her husband.
Yeah.
Barbara says, I had been told by people who knew him well that he was so embarrassed and angry that I had left him that he had to teach me a lesson and that he had to teach everyone else a lesson.
Monster.
Barbara's current attorney, Dick DeGuerin, says Barbara had to be careful and watch what she did and where she went. Quote, unfortunately, no safeguard is enough. If someone is after you, they're going to find you and they're going to get you. October 20th, 1980, Barbara stopped in a donut shop. As she was leaving, heading to her car in the parking lot, Barbara says that a black man approached her. Barbara says she knew right away what was going to happen and that it was the moment she was afraid of. In the reenactment, the guy is in the car with another person. He gets out, puts on a ski mask, and walks towards her car window, which is down. He pulls out a gun and just starts shooting her. But again, UM doesn't really include the full details of what actually happens in this moment. So this man comes to the side of her car, and he's pointing a paper bag at her. The man pulls the trigger of a .44 caliber revolver inside the bag, but the hammer catches on a pillow that's intended to muffle the sound of the shot, and the gun doesn't fire.
Whoa.
So this gives her enough time that she realizes what's happening. He removes the gun from the bag, but she's, like, desperately trying to put her car in reverse.
Oh, my God.
Slams on the accelerator and, like, ducks down and tries to, like, turn.
Oh, my God.
So she's, like, facing the passenger seat. So the car does go a few feet, but then stalls
because
of, like, her pressing the accelerator down all the way.
Oh, my God.
So then this allows the man to fire four shots into her back.
Four shots.
No, no, no.
So she immediately feels numb from the chest down, and she realizes that she can't get up. But so this little mistake with him with getting caught on the pillow saved her life.
Yeah. Because he would have shot her in the head.
Yes. Probably. He was like point blank ready to shoot her in the head.
Wow.
Also not included in UM, by total chance, a police patrol car is driving by right as this happens.
Oh, wow.
Which I think also helped save her life because immediately someone was informed that this was going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the two police officers inside sees the shooting and both officers hear the shots. They see the assailant jump into a Cadillac driven by a second black man. The officer gives chase, and at the same time, they radio for an ambulance. So she does have an ambulance called immediately, which is amazing.
Wow.
The ambulance arrives at the parking lot and takes Barbara to the hospital, where she undergoes emergency surgery. So Stack tells us that the bullets collapsed her lung, severed her spinal cord, and left her paralyzed from the chest down. And amazingly, she does not lose consciousness this whole time.
Wow.
And just really quickly right here, I wanted to interject the type of stuff that Barbara was doing and like what type of person she was before this. So she had entered a marathon, her first and only marathon before the shooting, where she came in second.
Oh, wow. My gosh.
She held the record for endurance water skiing with 80 miles at Lake Tahoe, California. She was a nationally ranked athlete, a snow skier, a scuba diver, and a professional model.
Oh, my gosh.
So I just want to show, like, what kind of devastation this was to the type of life she was leading.
Yeah.
When the paramedics asked who was responsible, she said Richard Mins.
Wow.
Like, she just...
She knew.
She had felt she was being followed. Like, he was haunting her life. Like, she knew it was him.
And the guy didn't rob her. He just came to kill her. Why would he do that?
He just came to kill her.
Mm-hmm. Did you see that one of the notes that he had written her said, to a beautiful woman, an amazing athlete, and a fortunate lover?
Oh, gross.
Yeah.
Ew, I hate him so much.
He's awful.
So then Stack has very unfortunate word choice, but he says, within minutes of the shooting, two small-time hoods from California, Nathaniel Ivory and Patrick Steen, were arrested for attempted murder.
Oh, boy.
Again, UM does not give details, but what happened was those two officers saw the two men speed away in the Cadillac, and then a short chase later, they crash into a pole.
Whoa.
And the two men jump out and run away on foot.
Oh, my gosh.
So not long after, they find Patrick Steen and Nathaniel Ivory hiding in a nearby field. So that's how they're apprehended.
Okay.
And, like, thank God, they were really terrible at this. So Stack says when Steen and Ivory were interrogated, they kept quiet and would not admit that Richard Mins was involved. The next night, detectives met with one of Richard's former bodyguards. The man did not want to go public, but said that a month earlier, a contract had been put out on Barbara's life. They ask him by who, and he says, Dudley. So this is Dudley Bell, the crooked PI that Richard had been working with. So they ask him who Dudley works for, and he says he works for Richard Min. They ask if Richard paid him, and he says no, Dudley did, but Dudley works for Richard. So in the reenactment, he's like, you dummies, I'm telling you, Richard is behind this. Like, I'm not saying it, but I'm saying it. But all of that was a completely separate incident. So the next day, police learned that a trucker in California named Robert Jess Anderson was the owner of the getaway car the men used to shoot Barbara. So Steens and Ivory tell the police that a guy named Bob Anderson hired them to kill Barbara. So this is all a little bit confusing, but what we have is Richard Mins hires Dudley Bell. Dudley Bell hires Bob Anderson. Bob Anderson hires Steens and Ivory, who shoot Barbara.
Oh, wow.
So that's how people get away with this shit. The next day, Dudley Bell's ex-wife gave police a note that connected Richard Min, Dudley Bell, and Robert Jess Anderson. The note was written on Richard Min's hotel stationery in Dudley Bell's handwriting, and there was a list of Robert Jess Anderson's guns on the back. But again, that's like circumstantial, maybe, you know?
Right.
October 28th, 1980, 8 days after the shooting, Robert Jess Anderson was arrested on charges of conspiring to commit a murder. In the interrogation room, Anderson is denying he knows the shooters, and the officer is like, no, they confessed, and they said you hired them, and, like, we have all this other evidence, like, we have you. So the officer tells him he's ready to cut him a deal that will probably ensure he doesn't go to jail at all if he cooperates and tells them what they need to know. Ted Wilson, the assistant DA, says they knew they needed his cooperation because they knew there were people above him that were involved, and they knew they needed to get to them. So Anderson ends up telling them, yes, Dudley Bell hired him, tells him what his involvement was, but then he says in the end, he called it off. He says that he suspected that Bell was working for Mins, but he didn't have proof. So Stack says, despite Anderson's cooperation, the DA said he simply did not have enough evidence to indict Dudley Bell or Richard Mins. Horrifyingly, Stack then tells us that Mins was never even questioned once during the investigation.
Oh, I forgot.
Is that because the, like, he had law enforcement on his side? Like, because of his connections?
Had to be.
Right? Yeah.
I've looked at it a few different ways. I can't think of any reason.
Yeah. And not just on his side, but probably that he's paying.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. He also continued to press the theft case against Barbara after this.
Oh, my God.
After trying to kill her.
Monster. He's such a fucking garbage person.
Truly the devil. So Dudley Bell did not finger Minns and tell the police he had hired the hit, because to do so would have been to confess that he himself was a link in the chain. And, of course, Bell is saying he's innocent in this, and Minns was probably just offering him money to be quiet about it.
Mm-hmm.
So less than a month after the shooting, Barbara appeared in court because of the theft charges, which Minns said Barbara's new attorney had staged as a publicity stunt.
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm going to get shot in the back four times as a publicity stunt.
Oh, my God.
It's so cruel.
So Barbara says, I was shot. I was paralyzed. I was sitting in the wheelchair. He wasn't being questioned. He wasn't being indicted. Neither were any of the other people who were involved. Yet here I was sitting in a courtroom, my first trip out of the hospital, facing theft charges that he had fabricated.
Ugh. How has she gone on?
I truly can't. I would die of anger. Like, yeah. I would actually die of anger.
I would just let it consume me. Like, the hate would just fully consume me.
It's just the most wrongdoing. So Stack tells us that the theft charges ended up being dropped on a technicality involving the search warrant. So Barbara didn't even get to prove her innocence, which is just so sad. Like, she, like, wanted to go to trial for this just to show that she wasn't the bad guy in any of this.
Yeah.
And that he was, you know? Like, I completely get it that she wanted to see this through. March 30th, 1981, Nathaniel Ivory and Patrick Steen were convicted of attempted murder and each sentenced to 35 years. Less than a year later, Barbara filed a civil suit for wrongful injury against Minns, Steen, Ivory, Anderson, and Bell. And I did read at one point that she was asking for $220 million.
Wow. Queen.
But of fucking course, before the deposition, Minns left the country and disappeared. Apparently, he avoided the suit by saying he was in ill health, despite the fact that witnesses reported to have seen him water skiing in the Bahamas.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Of course.
DA Ted Wilson says Minns remains a suspect in the case, but unfortunately, without more significant evidence, he can't be indicted or tried. Barbara's lawyer says lots of indictments have been made on less evidence than the state has on Dick Minns.
Like,
yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. He says he does not know why Minns hasn't been charged, that he should have been charged, and that no fair jury would find anyone other than Minns responsible. Just the fact that he wasn't even questioned is just
it's
bonkers.
Yeah.
Horrible. In 1984, as part of a separate investigation, the FBI recorded Robert Jess Anderson bragging about the hit on Barbara. He was then convicted of soliciting a murder and sentenced to 38 years. Bell was also arrested for soliciting a murder and in 1987 was convicted when one of his former employees testified in court that he'd tried to hire him to kill Barbara.
Oh, my God.
Bell was also sentenced to 38 years, but he was released on parole in 1991 after serving only 4.5. On 17 consecutive occasions, Min failed to appear in court for Barbara's civil suit. He was ultimately found in default, and the jury ordered him to pay $58 million plus costs. Author Suzanne Finsad says it's unusual that a civil suit could be brought on someone but not a criminal suit, but that's what happened in this case. And I would say it's not just unusual, it is completely enraging. It is very wrong.
Yeah.
Sergeant Ken Williamson says not all of the responsible parties in the shooting of Barbara Petrowski had been indicted and have not been convicted and sent to the penitentiary. He says at least four of them have, and that's the opinion of the authorities and the DA's office, that there is still one person who is higher up than everyone else who has not been indicted or convicted. So this case is not closed. So at this point, it's like the authorities are like, yeah, he's responsible for this, but now he's out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Stack then gives the update on Barbara. She has now changed her name to Jannie Smith and moved to Ohio. He says she has refused to accept the limitations of her paralysis. They show Barbara, they have some footage of her, and she's, like, in a sport wheelchair getting exercise. She says, you cannot go through something as devastating as what happened to me and dwell on it. You cannot. If you do, if you dwell on it, it will destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go on, and you have to find a way to find meaning in life, to do something meaningful with your life. And I swore when I was shot that if I lived through it, that I would find a way to make my life rewarding, fulfilling, and productive. And I've tried to do that since the time of my injury. And then they show a photo of her playing wheelchair tennis, which is very nice. So Stack says in 1993, Barbara, now Janie Smith, began rehabilitation with Dr. Gerald Petrovsky, which the subtitles say Petrovsky, which is her name, which was very confusing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, and with what happens, mm-hmm. it's weird because yes. I was like, is that how she got her name?
I know. Mm-hmm. And I swear they said it too, but it must have been just the subtitles and that's how I was hearing it because I was reading it. It was really confusing. So she begins rehabilitation with Dr. Gerald Petrovsky, who was experimenting with a device which allows a paralyzed person to walk independently. As collaborators, they perfected the system. So it's like this system they developed that has electrical impulses that mimic like muscle signals.
Wow.
So they say today, Janie Smith is president and co-founder of the Petrovsky Centers in Irvine, California and Scranton, Pennsylvania. So this whole like center was based on rehabbing people that were in similar situations to her. She is also a nurse and works with patients at the centers, especially children. Mm. So November 30th, 1991, Janie Smith and Dr. Gerald Petrovsky were married.
Aww.
And they show this over footage from their wedding where she is walking down the aisle using the device that mm-hmm. they worked on together.
That's so nice.
Stack finally wraps the 30-minute segment. By saying that Richard Mins has been seen in Texas, the Caribbean, Israel, and London, but is based in Switzerland. He also now goes by the name Richard O'Toole and says he's an international tax attorney. So I thought it was funny on fandom.com. It was like, you know, they list out aliases a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the aliases were Dick and Richard O'Toole. And I was like, it's perfect because he's a dick and a fucking tool. He says Mins has also reportedly transferred all of his assets offshore to dummy corporations.
Of course.
Janie Smith has never collected a penny.
Oh, my gosh.
So then we have an update screen, and it says Richard Mins was arrested and served a four-month prison term for passport fraud.
No.
No.
What the hell?
Barbara's civil suit against Mins was eventually dismissed, and that's all we get in the update. So, Richard and how he got caught. So this blurb is straight from fandom because it just summarizes it well. It says, a two-year covert operation resulted in the arrest of Richard Mins in 1994 when he was 64. So as a side note, it sounds like he did live in both Ireland and England for a while.
Okay.
July 19th, 1994, he boarded a plane in Mexico with a stopover in the United States. When the plane touched down at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, the State Department's Security Service took him into custody on suspicion of obtaining several passports with fraudulent information and names. At the time, he was using the alias Harlan Allen Richardson. When arrested, he was carrying seven passports from four different countries and under five different names.
Oh, my God.
But that's what they arrested him on? Like, did they know about the other things at this time?
I mean, I think they always do, and they have to get you on anything they can get you on.
Yeah.
That was all they had to get him on. In November 1994, Richard pleaded guilty to 8 counts of passport fraud. He was sentenced to 4 months in prison and fined $100,000. So I read that, like, he definitely made some sort of deal for this. Like, even that, like, wasn't the amount of time he should have served for that stuff.
I wonder what kind of deal he made.
Yeah, I don't know. Well,
and that $100,000 should have gone to her.
Yes.
Like, the department or whoever, the justice system should have been like, we're never going to be able to get him to pay for his civil suit. We will give our $100,000 fine that he's going to pay us to his victim.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They should have done that.
And then, later in November, he is deported back to Ireland, where he holds a passport because he was in the United States illegally. And then he later returns to Switzerland.
Wow.
Yeah, so this was a blurb. It said he was deported last year after pleading guilty to passport fraud and cannot re-enter the United States without the permission of Attorney General Janet Reno, said George Bishop, Mins's attorney. The bottom line is, he didn't get a fair trial, Bishop said. Dick DeGuerin, an attorney representing Petrovsky, said he will file for a rehearing before the appeals court and that the opinion will be appealed to the Texas Supreme Court if necessary. Writing for the appeals court, Justice Bill Vance cited 9 points of error by now-retired family court judge Bill Elliott. The errors included the lack of a pleading or proof that Mins intentionally caused Petrowski's injuries. Vance also said there was insufficient evidence to support punitive damages and that the award was excessive and that the court abused its discretion in refusing to admit evidence concerning Petrowski's credibility and veracity.
Oh my
God. The 1987 gross. Decision awarded Petrowski $18.1 million in actual damages and $14 million in punitive damages. Mins now lives in Switzerland, Bishop said. So then in May 1995, Janney's civil suit against him is reversed because he kept just not appearing for court and because the appeals court said that it had not been proven that he intentionally caused her injuries.
Oh, my gosh. He hired someone to kill her. That is intentionally causing someone injury.
And basically what that's saying is, oh, if they just don't show up, we're going to reverse it eventually.
Yeah. No. Yeah, so it eventually was just dismissed and he ended up paying nothing. So Janney later sued the city of Houston.
Good.
Claiming that the Houston Police Department knew about the hit a month before the shooting but did nothing to protect her.
Wow.
So what she's referencing is that fucking thing that was put in her car.
Yes.
Because that was clearly intended to help murder her by stalling her car so someone could come kill her.
Wow. Yes.
But they did nothing about it. She also claimed that members of the police department were hired by Richard to harass her.
Obviously.
Yeah, when they busted into her apartment and let him take everything. Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%. In January of 1998, a federal jury awarded Janney $22 million in that case. However, in January 2001, a federal appeals court reversed the decision.
Jesus.
So what it came down to essentially was that they said, even if, like, individual officers in our police department were involved in this, if you want to sue the city, you have to prove that there's a pattern of this type of behavior.
This poor woman.
And there was no pattern of the behavior, so she couldn't sue the city.
Oh, my God.
It's, like, so maddening.
Yes.
Like you said, I don't know how she went on. At some point, Barbara was also on an episode of 60 Minutes. As we know, the book Sleeping with the Devil was written about Barbara and Richard. And in 1997, they made a movie based on the book, also called Sleeping with the Devil.
Hmm.
I found this and I just thought it was interesting. Janney, at the time, had written this letter to a colleague of her husband's at the School of Allied Health. And I'm not sure why, but it said, "Dear Carol, as promised, I am sending some of my thoughts about the television movie to be aired on CBS this month. These are informal musings I scratched down quickly in no particular order. This movie is not my life story. I served as a member of the production team and as a technical advisor. I also had an infinitely tiny acting part, which was great fun. A few events from my life became a springboard for the script. There are many things in the movie that are contrary to who I am, what I stand for, and what I believe. I asked the producer not to use my name, and he was kind enough to comply. The character does not reflect my attitude, feelings, or beliefs.
Huh.
The movie does not include any of my hard-won accomplishments or the work I've been involved in all these years. Mm. It also does not include Dr. Petrovsky's Nobel Prize nomination.
Wow.
This movie is going to help me fulfill a lifelong dream, to go to medical school. I've had numerous movie and book offers over the years, and although many of them were generous, I've always declined. But in this case, the timing seemed providential. I want to attend medical school, hopefully at Loma Linda, and this movie has provided me with the tuition to do so.
Wow.
I was shot 4 times at point-blank range, and as a result, I am paralyzed from the chest down.
Mm.
When those 4 bullets struck my body, I prayed that my life would be spared. And I promised that if it was, I would make my life as rich and productive and fulfilling as possible. I have always been grateful that my prayer was answered. The character in the movie becomes bitter and angry when she learns of her paralysis because this is a more normal response.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I think it's a shame that it was done that way because it doesn't acknowledge the power of prayer and the gratitude we owe for our good fortune.
Wow.
At one point in my life, walking was my dream and I pursued it vigorously. It was exhilarating beyond words when that dream came true. But I hope this movie does not send a message that walking is the end all for people with paralysis.
Mm.
Really, it's something most 2-year-olds can do, and it shouldn't define you as a human being.
Wow.
I do hope, instead, that the movie inspires people to go after their dreams, whatever those dreams might be. All of the actors, members of the production team, crew, and extras were a great pleasure to work with. Shannon Doherty was an angel who put in endless hours training for this role. So Shannon played her in the movie.
Oh my God.
I think she gave what reads in the script as a weak, self-possessed, whiny character an extraordinary strength. Sincerely, Janie Smith. So I just thought that was interesting.
Oh, wow.
It sounds like the movie did not depict her as a person, but kind of followed the story.
She is so incredible.
Yeah, I know.
She really is.
So there were just a few other achievements of Janie's that I wanted to share. This is another quote from her. "It was rough after the shooting, but I never wanted to give up or die. Never. The most important thing for me was that I wanted to walk again," she said. "Everyone told me, 'You're crazy.' That just made me more determined. I decided I was going to give myself 5 years, and in 1985, in the Honolulu Marathon, with the help of computerized electronic stimulus equipment, I stood up and walked 7 miles.
Wow.
She walked 7 miles in a marathon.
Oh, my God.
In 1990, Janie was honored as one of the 10 outstanding young Americans by the USJCs. And as we know, in 1991, she got married. She walked down the aisle at her wedding. She co-founded this medical center with her husband.
Jeez.
Also, at one point, she became the top wheelchair tennis player in the world and the second-ranked marathoner.
Oh, my God.
Which is so cool because Eliza knows, but my uncle was also paralyzed while doing something active and also played wheelchair tennis and was professional. So,
wow.
I just thought that was really cool.
Cool.
So people on the message boards agree on a few things. First, that Minz is totally responsible for this.
Yeah, obviously.
Allegedly. Second, that this is one of the most frustrating cases ever on UM. Mm. And this is, like, one of the biggest dick bitches we've ever seen. Just, like, ugh. Someone actually wrote to us about how much they hate this guy. Like, before we covered this.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone also agrees that he got away with things because of his money and his status.
Of course.
Yeah, he was definitely paying people and all that. And then lastly, several folks agree that the saxophone music in the segment was really terrible and distracting. And then I found one comment from Robin Warder in 2017 that I thought was interesting. So he said, "Rewatched this again for the first time in ages. The one thing that took me by surprise was seeing an interview with Dick DeGuerin, who was Barbara's lawyer during her lawsuit. As you might know, DeGuerin was prominently featured in The Jinx because he went on to become Robert Durst's lawyer and got him acquitted for murder by claiming self-defense."
I didn't realize that. Oh, my God.
He says, "Quite ironic when you consider that Durst and Richard Minns were both prime examples of guys who got away with an awful lot because of their wealth."
Wow.
He says, "Though karma eventually caught up to Durst." And then another user commented right after Robin and said, "DeGuerin also defended David Koresh and Tom DeLay, two big Texan dicks."
Jeez.
Everything's bigger in Texas, right?
Oh, my gosh.
So Koresh was a cult leader for the Branch Davidians with allegations of child abuse and statutory rape. And DeLay was a Republican politician who went to jail for campaigning money laundering.
Yep.
I thought it was pronounced Koresh.
Koresh.
Oh, Koresh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did I say?
Koresh. Yeah.
Wow. So that's a disappointment for that lawyer.
I know. So I really regret to inform you that he is still alive.
Ugh.
He is just living his fucking life in Israel.
Okay.
He is in his 80s now. And he, very upsettingly, when you just look up him, what comes up is his sculptures, because he's a kind of famous sculptor in Israel.
What?
Which is totally barf-worthy.
Fuck him. I hate him so much.
So he sculpted these statues, which are used as the awards for the Ayn Rand Atlas Awards.
Oh, God.
So,
that tracks.
So the Ayn Rand Institute promotes him, which is disgusting. But this is a blurb from the website of Hay Hill Gallery, which is where his sculptures are on display. And it said, "The event was accompanied by a showing of sculptures by Richard Minns, which are based on Rand's most famous novel, Atlas Shrugged.
Gross.
A cautionary tale about a dystopian socialist United States. Minns, the 85-year-old sculptor, led a small group of us past his work, explaining what they meant. Quote, 'Atlas is really angry with all the freeloaders, and he's smashing his way out of the world,' he said. And in one," he added, gesturing to a figure holding a lassoed bronze globe, He is free of freeloaders and has created his perfect world.
Gross.
And I also read that he sculpted his own face as the face of Atlas in these sculptures.
Of course he did. Of course he did.
Because he is so barf-worthy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Basically, everyone else involved in this case has since died. They've all died between the 90s and now. But fucking Richard is still alive.
Everything worked out for Dick Minns, just living his best life.
Yep. So I did try to look into Barbara and Gerald. It does look like the Petrovsky Centers are no longer in business, and I'm not sure why. I couldn't really figure that out. Hmm. I also can't tell if they're still married. It does appear that she lives right next to Loma Linda University, which he works for again.
Okay.
So probably, and they did have some shared addresses in the last few years, but it was kind of hard to tell what was what. Mm-hmm. But I did find this, which I thought was really sweet. Janny, who she now goes also by the name Janica Petrovska.
Okay.
So, and I think that's like a fully Polish name. So she just kind of adapted back to like a Polish name. And so I found that she had founded something called the Humpty Dumpty House Foundation in 2011. Mm-hmm. So I pulled the blurb from their website of like the about part of their website. And it says, how do you rebuild a shattered life? People do die of hunger in America, and many go without critically needed medical care. Diabetes has reached epidemic numbers in our children, largely due to the habits we as a society have adopted. Can you imagine starting out life with such a burden? Maybe it's time for a change. Humpty Dumpty House was founded by Janica Petrovska, a gardener, biologist, wheelchair athlete, third-year medical student, designer, and one of the JC's 10 Outstanding Young Persons of the World for medical innovation based on her work in paralysis research and clinical rehabilitation.
Wow.
Paralyzed from the chest down and bedridden from the effects of third-degree burns, inhalation injuries, pressure sores, poverty, and isolation, Janica experienced firsthand the devastation that results from lack of food, funds, and medical care. She vowed that if she made it through her ordeal, she would do anything she could to make sure others in her community would never have to experience it. During her time of grief from the loss of her dream to become a doctor, she threw herself into the hard physical labor of designing and building a series of gardens, mostly with discards from the neighborhood. Alma Fajardo, a disadvantaged teenager with a transplanted heart and diabetes from the age of 8, helped her. Together, they created the Humpty Dumpty House Gardens. Their message was that with love and care, even things regarded by society as broken and useless could be given a second life, a chance to be seen as beautiful and to serve a worthy purpose. The gardens received local acclaim and have been used to stage fundraising garden tours for worthy organizations. Volunteers, many with disabilities, grow wholesome organic foods in wheelchair-accessible raised vegetable beds throughout the property, and this food is made available to others with disabilities, struggling families, and the local elderly poor who come harvest for themselves. The gardens have evolved into a local attraction graced by art and sculpture created by some of the area's most notable artists, intermingled with lush food plantings and treasures rescued from trash cans and dumpsters. And then there was just a quote from her. I started Humpty Dumpty House in deep despair, with neighborhood trash and a younger helper with a serious medical condition, and have seen it grow into a series of picturesque garden rooms that provide food for locals in need and funds for good causes, as well as inspiration and delight to weary medical students, worried family members visiting sick loved ones in the hospital, and mothers who bring their little ones in wheelchairs. If you feel your life is beyond repair and can't be turned around, come talk to us at Humpty Dumpty House. We don't want to let you slip through the cracks.
Oh, my gosh. I have goosebumps.
I know.
I'm a garbage human.
Me too. God, I'm awful.
Oh, my God.
The world is, like, not worthy of someone like her.
Seriously.
We, like, truly do not deserve a person like that.
I can't even believe everything
she's
done.
And what if she had... Oh, gosh. My gosh. What a hero.
Seriously. She's amazing. She is amazing. Wow. So, yeah, not exactly a happy ending.
Fuck him. I just want to, like, fly to Israel and punch him in the dick.
Oh, yeah.
I hate him.
The fact that he...
Oh, he's awful.
Just...
His life is amazing. Like, he truly just got to do whatever he wanted to do. He had no repercussions, a couple months in jail.
4 months.
And now he's living in a country and people are acting like he's a hero because he's a sculptor.
Yeah. Like, he's got write-ups and stuff. And people have called it out online and been like, are you fucking serious with this write-up on this guy?
He's a fucking monster. Google him.
You know what he's done. Everyone knows what he's done.
And he hasn't even bothered to change his name.
No, because he's a narcissist. He's he's a total narcissist.
Yeah. Like even
And of course he's sculpting fucking Atlas Shrugged with his face on the character. The whole thing makes me so sick.
The douchiest.
Ugh. Garbage. So disgusting. Garbage. Kill it with fire.
So frustrating.
Oh my God.
But I'm glad that Janica has, you know.
Yeah.
She's come around to, amazing. Like, live a life that she can be really proud of, and that's amazing.
She's an incredible person.
Yeah.
Just an incredible person. Wow. Wow. Nice work, girl. I know that was a lot.
That was a lot.
Good job. you crushed it. You did it.
My name's Brian Stratton.
And I'm Rob Milne.
And we co-host Marvel by the Month, a podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. From August 1961 to whenever they decide to stop making these things.
It's like the best book club in the world, hosted by guys who thought they knew a lot more about this stuff before they started this podcast.
Look for Marvel by the Month wherever you get your podcasts or at marvelbythemonth.com.
All right. So the second and last segment of season 4, episode 20, is the story of Catherine Bennett. Stack begins by saying that it seems like every town in America has a village recluse, a mysterious soul who chooses to remain alone, isolated from the community. Catherine Bennett of Portland, Oregon.
Oh, hey. Yeah.
I was like, why am I doing this segment? Was just such a person. Catherine was a, quote, destitute pack rat, which I don't love that.
No.
Who dressed in men's clothing, rarely left her home, and refused to discuss her past with anyone. And Catherine's outfit in the reenactment is very Portlandy. It's a big, oversized, cozy sweater over, like, a button-up flannel with a pair of Dickies.
Love it.
So I feel like, you know, Catherine was maybe OG of Portland style.
Mm-hmm.
So for years, Catherine was viewed with curiosity by sympathetic neighbors. What no one had suspected was that Catherine had amassed a modest fortune with more than $125,000. But on the day she died, Catherine Bennett was a woman with few friends and no family. Perhaps one of our viewers can help find the heir to her estate. Little is known about Catherine before 1941. That year, she met a handsome young soldier named Gilbert Bennett. 6 months later, they were married. After the Second World War, they settled in Portland, Oregon, where Gilbert worked as a professional photographer. Catherine became his favorite subject. The two shared a love for the great outdoors. At every opportunity, they would escape to the unspoiled rivers of the Pacific Northwest.
Hmm.
And I love this reenactment because it's all places in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Marion Bennett, Catherine's brother-in-law, says that they loved the outdoor life and they'd fish every chance they got. They were very devoted to each other. Truly, they were inseparable. Every place they went together. He says that he's very sure that they were very much in love with each other. And the reenactment couple is so adorable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're just the cutest little things.
Mm-hmm.
Gilbert and Catherine never had children, which is probably why they liked each other so much. Just kidding. Stack says that instead, they built a loving private universe for the two. Catherine lavished attention on her husband, her garden, and her pets. Dream.
Oh, so nice.
Yet she remained intensely private about her past. Marion says that she never spoke of her past. He says that he asked all of his brothers and sisters, and they had said the same thing. No one in the family knew anything of Katie's past. Stack says that in 1980, after 38 years of marriage, Gilbert Bennett died. So sad.
So sad.
Catherine's world began to crumble. Marion says that when she lost Gilbert, she lost everything. Marion asked Katie about her relatives, but she said that she was raised in an orphan home and didn't have any relatives. He says that Catherine withdrew and wouldn't come to holiday dinners when invited, and Marion says that eventually they lost contact with her. Stack says that Catherine rarely left the home where she and Gilbert had spent so many years together. He says that in the end, only the charity of neighbors kept her from total seclusion. In June of 1990, after 10 years alone, Catherine Bennett passed away. She was 80 years old. When no blood relatives could be located, representatives from the Oregon Division of State Lands were dispatched to Catherine's house to sort out her estate. Almost no one had entered the house in the 10 years since her husband had died.
Larry Larimer, estate administrator, says that her home was unkempt. It was cluttered, it was dirty. It was flea-infested, and it had an odor. It was as if a hermit had lived there. He says that Mr. Bennett's clothing was still draped over the back of the chairs in the bedroom. Marcella Easley, the trust property manager, says that you could hardly even walk through it. It was such a mess. Papers and bottles and garbage and uneaten food. Marcella says that she had several animals, including cats. There was cat food everywhere and cat food tins. She said the fleas were unreal. You could just feel them all over you as you walked in. It was really bad. Larimer says that his first job is to locate a will or locate heirs. He says that when they enter a home, they quickly sift through the personal papers looking for letters, insurance policies, anything that might lead to an heir. Stack says investigators never discovered a will, but they were surprised to discover that despite her surroundings, Catherine Bennett was anything but destitute. They came across unopened Social Security checks dating back to 1981 and valued at more than $30,000. In addition to loose change, they found a number of coins worth $1,500. And finally, investigators discovered that Catherine had squirreled away nearly $60,000 in two separate bank accounts. After her house was sold, the value of Catherine's estate was valued at more than $125,000. Stack says that officials in Oregon have launched an extensive search for Catherine's heirs because Gilbert is dead and state law requires that the estate goes to the nearest blood relative. What complicates this is the fact that almost nothing is known about Catherine's past, and much of what is known is fraught with contradiction. Catherine Bennett was born in Kansas City, Kansas, in 1910. She once told her in-laws that she was raised in a Catholic orphanage after the death of her parents. However, a document notarized in 1945, 3 years after she was married, Catherine presented a completely different story about her life. She had said that her father had died prior to her birth, but that her mother was still alive and married to Joseph Fabick of Kansas City. The document also mentioned a brother named Martin Juratovich. Then there is an update that says that a distant relative of Catherine's was located and awarded half of the estate. No other relatives have come forward, so the remaining money went to the Oregon State Treasury. Lucky Oregon. Okay, so aside from the update, I don't have much to add here. There isn't any information about who the relative was that inherited the money and whether or not it was because of the UM segment or through other channels. I also weirdly tried to find Larry Larimer and Marcella Easley because I was going to email them to see if they had any additional information, but I wasn't able to find either of them, which is pretty weird. So all I have is from the UM Wiki and then a little from sitcoms online. So Catherine was born Catherine Juratovich in Austria on May 2nd, 1910, to Barbara Juratovich, and her father died likely before she was born. Around 1912, Barbara immigrated to the United States and met Joseph Joe Fabick in Kansas City, Kansas. His previous wife, Catherine, had died in 1916 and left him to raise their four children. He and Barbara married on July 4th, 1917 in Kansas City. Catherine and her brother Martin immigrated to the United States in 1924. The sitcom's online user Everybody Loves RS went through the census and found a little bit more information. Catherine and her brother immigrated to the United States from Croatia, and Catherine's stepfather, Joe Fabick, was Croatian as well. By 1935, Catherine was in Kansas City, Missouri, where she might have met Gilbert, who was also living there at the time. Joe died in 1951, Barbara died a year later in 1952, and Martin died in 1968. All three are buried at the Mount Calvary Catholic Cemetery in Kansas City, Kansas. And then Catherine and Gilbert are buried at the Willamette National Cemetery in Southeast Portland. Yeah. And that's all I have. If the state couldn't find her, we're not going to be able to find much out about her.
Yeah, I'm just so curious how the person was, the blood relative was found.
That was really the only thing I wanted to find out. I think that UM would have said it was through the show, so it must have been through other channels that this person was located.
I think so too. And you know, they would post stuff in the papers, and back then people read the papers. So
yeah, truly, what a dream scenario to get like what $60,000 or something from an aunt that you didn't even know existed that you've never met. I know.
I know. It's such a bummer.
Maybe she's my aunt. Maybe I should look into it.
You guys have been here for a while. Well, I also read that the statute of limitations has expired, so Oregon got to keep the money.
Oh, okay. Of course they did. Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
All right. A 7-minute segment to wrap up.
We love it. To wrap up Carlin's hour-long baby.
Okay. I have things to share.
Yay. I love that.
I know. It's only because we've taken a bit of a break.
Mm-hmm.
So Okay. This is what I'll start with. We watched The Landscapers on HBO with Olivia Colman, and I'm pulling up the other guy's name, but he's in Harry Potter. Oh, David Thewlis. It's so good. True crime fans will love it because it's based on a real couple in England that was accused of murder. And
what? I haven't even heard of this.
Yeah, I think somebody's recommended it to us, haven't they?
Really?
So.
I talked about it to you guys, I think.
Oh, already. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
But it's only 4 episodes, so it's very short. And, of course, Olivia Colman is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
The way they do it is very interesting. Like, the character, who's based on a real person, loves Westerns. And so the art direction, like, will sometimes actually have the characters in a Western.
Oh, neat.
But still, like, living out the story. And then it, like, goes back into, you know. And it's hard to explain, but I highly recommend. It's very good.
Nice.
Yeah.
So mine is, there was recently an update to the West Memphis 3 case.
All right.
Yes.
Carlin went on a little journey.
Where some new information came out. So I had never seen Paradise Lost, so I watched all of it.
It's amazing, right?
And it's so amazing, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just, like, fell into a huge rabbit hole about that case and listened to, like, a bunch of other people's episodes about that and just dwelled in that for a while I was really sick. So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's just really crazy that there's an update now, and I just cannot wait to hear what's going to happen. And I just think it's so amazing that documentary really, like, was responsible for bringing so much light to this case and kind of, like, getting it to where it is currently.
Yeah.
So highly recommend if you've never watched it. It's such a wild one, and they did a really good job.
I think I've watched those documentaries, like, 4 or 5 times.
Yeah,
like,
I would for sure rewatch.
There's so much info. It's just incredible, incredible documentary series.
Yeah. Because, like, I just knew the broad scope of sort of what happened. So it was really cool to, like, deep dive and get all the info.
Yeah. I have a recommendation, but it comes with a huge, huge trigger warning because it was, like, super, super bummer. And I made a mistake of, like, binging it. And so it's a CBC podcast. It's called Hunting Warhead. And it is about the hunt for this person who created these child sexual abuse image websites.
Mm-hmm. No.
And it is the hunt for the person, and then once the person is caught, it is interviews with the person.
No.
And it's really, really rough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I'm recommending it because there was a lot of stuff that I didn't even know. And what I learned was more upsetting than I thought could possibly be.
Mm-hmm. No.
I think it's an important listen. So, you know, obviously if this is something that deeply triggers you, don't listen to it. And even if it doesn't deeply trigger you, you will be very upset. But I think it's important because there was a lot of things that I didn't know when it comes to the trafficking of children and these sexual abuse images and how these people set up these forums and websites and get away with it. Mm. And yeah, so I recommend it. But like I said, it's not an easy listen, and you shouldn't sit and listen to it for 6 hours like I did.
I can't. This is not what I would expect from you.
Yeah, you know, I kind of fell into it. I listened to one CBC podcast. The other one I listened to, I listened to two others. One was called White Hot Hate, which was also very upsetting. It was about the white power movement in Canada and how it's connected to the military.
Oh, wow. God.
Yeah, that was really, really bananas too. And then I listened to another one called A Death in Cryptoland about this guy who created this website, this cryptocurrency website, and then maybe faked his own death and left with like $21 million or something, like ripped off all of these like people that had invested. Yeah. And then I heard an ad for this on those and I was like, oh. And, I knew that it was going to be upsetting, but it was like profoundly upsetting. There were a couple of times where I was like, I'm not going to listen to this anymore. But then I was like, well, I should listen to it. Like, it's important information to know. But then when they start interviewing the guy, it's just like, it becomes like really, he's just such a terrible person. Wow. It's just like gross. Mm. It's a really gross world out there. I mean, you know, but I do think it's something to know about. And I like learned some stuff and I was like, oh, I never would have thought.
God.
Yeah, so if you think you can get through it, definitely listen to it. It's called Hunting Warhead, and it's by the CBC, and they always do really amazing work.
Amazing.
Wow. So that's my sad recommendation.
Mama.
Hoo-hwee.
Hoo-hwee. Time to drink some more
Malort.
I've been sitting up here through my hour-long segment, and that was the only alcohol I had. I thought about it.
Wow. No, jeez. Thank you. I do want to say that the taste went away about 30 minutes.
Oh, yes. We forgot to give an update. I agree. Yeah. My time was about 30 minutes.
Yeah. I didn't want to interrupt her, but it did take about 30 minutes for that to leave my palate.
Well, and a little peek behind the curtain. We did think we had lost one of our files for our introduction and Carlin's whole segment. And so we were, our biggest concern basically was that we would have to fake the Malort drinking again or have to do it again.
We weren't going
to
do it.
I didn't even think about that. I was just like, no, I can't present this case again.
Carlin, yes. No.
Yeah. I said to Elizabeth, I was like, if we have to record this again, we have to find another day to do it because I am not doing that again. I'm not drinking that again.
But then I was going to text you and be like, so have you drank all your Malort out of wanting to drink yourself to death from this very traumatic situation that we were just in?
My Tupperware is just empty.
Just a little peek. Okay.
Oh, goodness.
So next episode is going to be a two-parter. And, if you've got sharp ears, you might have heard a kitty just now.
A little meow, meow.
A little meow, meow. She's doing her little chatter at one of the birds out there because also breaking news, y'all, the sun is out in Portland on January 8th.
It's amazing.
Happy New Year to us. It is truly life-giving, even though it's burning my retinas right now. Okay, so Carlin has the first segment.
So for episode 21, it is the wanted segment of Marie Lilienberg and Maria Valene.
And then I have the second segment, and it is a lost love segment about a man named Joe Soul.
And then in part two, I have the unexplained death of Gary Simmons.
And then I wrap up part two with a fraud segment of Richard Condia.
Okay.
All right. Well.
Well, we love you.
We love you, but not the Malort. But we love you, but not the Malort.
And we don't love Richard...
Mins.
No.
Basically, we could just replace Dick Bitch with Dick Mins now.
Yeah, he's a real Dick Mins.
Yep. We could.
Yep.
All right, we love you, Carlin. Amazing job on that horrible segment.
Thank you. I'm going to drink more Malort now.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies in the mail. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast and on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box, 14005, Portland, Oregon, 97293. Send us your stories for listener short stack episodes. If you want to email us your favorite unsolved mystery story or cold case or any nostalgia you have surrounding the show, send it our way because we love to hear from you. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, leave a 5-star review and tell a friend or tell 2 or tell 3. Don't forget, for every review we receive, we donate $1 to a different nonprofit.
understand. I've never had a drink that lasts that long in your mouth. It's very strange. Super gross.
My Key Lime LaCroix is getting rid of it pretty well.
Really?
Yeah. All right.
I want Kuf to try and see if she likes it.
I would be surprised if Kuf hasn't had it.
Malort, probably not. But I know that from being like German and stuff, there's a lot of wacky like herbal German cordials.
Yeah. So. Well, I was going to say like even Underberg makes me think of this a little bit.
Yeah, I could see that.